Thank you, Al. And I assume you'll all think carefully about the threat of installed psychologists in APRA. I am absolutely intrigued by that concept, and I think we should discuss it further a little later in the session. In the meantime, our next speaker has really, I think, lived the evolution in risk management over a number of sectors. Narelle Pine is currently the Group Head, Risk Policy and Governance at Origin Energy. Now, she's recently returned to Australia. She's travelled widely over the course of her career. She began it as a graduate at Coopers and Lybrand here in Sydney, and she worked in the Global Risk Management Solutions practice at PwC until 2001 when she moved to London. Now, she worked there at AIG Consultants for 2 years. She joined the RBS Group in 2003 and held a number of different roles in the group risk team. In 2008, she joined Lloyd's Banking Group, where Narelle was the head of environmental and reputational risk for their wholesale and international banking division. As I said, she returned to Australia in April 2002, where her tan recovered, no doubt. I would like to welcome her now to the stage, Narelle Pine.
Thanks, Annabelle. Thank you. Good morning. I would like to share with you two examples from my own experience and show you how in each scenario the risk team and consequently the organisation endeavoured to stay ahead of the risk. But first, let's look back at the risk landscape of the last 10 years to set the scene. So the last 10 years has presented a complex landscape. The landscape has been punctuated by a number of economic global events, corporate collapses, natural disasters, and terrorist activity. Add to that an increasing volume of regulatory change and activist activity, and what you have is a minefield of risk and opportunity. Thank you. With that in mind, what do you need to stay ahead? Well, in the absence of a crystal ball, what we need is a structured approach to manage uncertainty. I'd like to now bring that to life. The first example that I would like to share with you takes us back to 2007. At the time, I was working in group risk in RBS's London headquarters. The financial markets were strong, and the popping of champagne corks was a familiar sound in most of the city's drinking horns. RBS in 2007 was equally as strong. Highlights of the annual results from the year ended 31 December 2006 included, on a year-on-year basis, group operating profit was up by 14%, the cost-to-income ratio was 42%, profit after tax was up 17%, and the adjusted earnings per share was at a prisely 14%. As you can see from this slide, the company was diverse in brand, product, and geography. So a snapshot of the group as it was then in 2007. There were 50 brands, 71 businesses. We operated across 25 countries, 198 countries that we also had ventures in, 1,000 products under management, over 140,000 members of staff. In that year alone, there were 102 new pieces of legislation or regulation that came into force. And in our team alone, my team alone, we had 49 staff changes in a small enterprise risk community. Amongst this diversity and this complexity, working in a central risk function presented its own set of challenges. However, the scale and breadth and depth of the risk exposures that we managed were well understood. A global risk survey, an Aon Global Risk Survey undertaken by Aon in 2007 identified at that time that the top 10 risks in banking were as seen on screen. The column to the far right shows the percentage of respondents who actually had undertaken a review on that particular risk or actually had an action plan in place to manage that risk. Reputation risk at the time was a discipline that was gaining momentum. It was a hot topic, and it was talked about repeatedly at industry functions and conferences. Yet it was still embryonic in its application to risk management system at RBS. I was tasked to develop an approach to managing reputational risk. There was an established and fully embedded group operational risk framework. However, the identification, assessment, and more importantly, the quantification of reputational risk had not been formalised. So let's have a look at what is reputation. Reputation is an opinion held about something or someone. This opinion may not necessarily be based on fact. John Wooden, a well-known American coach and basketball player, once declared, "Be more concerned with your character than your reputation, because your character is what you really are, while your reputation is merely what others think you are." Or more flippantly, I like to think of it as reputation is character minus what you've been caught doing. Reputation is based on perception. I'm sure you've all seen this image before, and we all perceive things quite differently. So can you damage your reputation? Well, of course you can. Before Enron's collapse on the 2nd of December in 2001, Fortune magazine named Enron America's most innovative company for 6 consecutive years. Suffice to say, they didn't feature in the 2002 honor roll. So how do you damage your reputation? Well, at the most basic level, by failing to meet expectations. The challenge comes from having multiple stakeholders with often conflicting interests and expectations. Reputational risk, therefore, is the consequential impact of failing to meet these stakeholder expectations, loss of confidence, reluctance to do business, and erosion of trust. We identified that damage to reputation was a consequence of 3 actions: by the way we conducted ourselves as a business, by the way we transacted with our customers through the selling of products and services, and thirdly, which was often the more difficult to understand and manage, was by our association with our customers. For example, providing finance to customers who operated in highly sensitive sectors. Ideally, what we were wanting to avoid was appearing on the front page of the Times. Whilst the negative impact of reputational damage was difficult to quantify, the associated knock-on impacts of a poor reputation were well understood, such as lost revenue, destruction, and destruction of shareholder value. So what did we do to stay ahead? We developed a policy, which you can see on the screen, which was supported by a framework and included practical guidance and reference material for all colleagues to be better positioned to identify and assess reputational risk. This was rolled out across the company by focused training sessions, and to embed the thinking, it was integrated into other key business processes across the group, from account opening in the retail bank to strategic planning and the group's new product approval process in the corporate end of the business. The rollout of the policy was considered to be highly successful, as it provided a new lens through which to make risk-based decisions which were informed and thoughtful. I'd now like to roll forward to today and the second example of staying ahead of the risk. This relates to my current role in group risk at Origin Energy. I joined Origin last August and have been thoughtful in the time since about the differences presented in a change of industry, country, and the resulting risk profile. So a snapshot of Origin Energy. It's the leading Australian integrated energy company. It's a top 20 ASX listed company. Our operations span the energy life cycle. We have just under 6,000 employees, just over 150,000 shareholders, and we have currently approximately 4.3 million customers. So as you can see, Origin Energy presents its own set of complexities. Origin presents a different set of risks compared to financial services. Whilst credit risk is obviously still relevant in some parts of our business, it is no surprise that given the nature of our business and the associated operational impacts, that health and safety sits very high on our list of priorities. Origin's first priority is to provide a safe workplace and to allow our people to arrive home safely every evening. In the past 2 years, Origin has recorded just over 2,500 incidents, hazards and unsafe acts, with the potential for serious injury or fatality. So over a two-year basis, if we take that as approximately 730 days, this translates into approximately 4 reportable events a day. We were not prepared to accept this performance, as people were fundamentally at risk. So what have we done to stay ahead? We've conducted some focused work over the last 6 months where we've evaluated all the high-risk activities and the factors which are involved in our day-to-day businesses. That involved a review of approximately 38,000 incidences in our corporate databases. We utilised a lot of industry guidance and existing benchmarks to formulate an approach to managing these risks. The output and the approach was endorsed by our executive management team, and the resulting piece of work was company-wide life-saving rules. The life-saving rules relate to some of the highest risk tasks performed at Origin and are designed to eliminate unsafe choice. Many companies have life-saving rules, or golden rules, or cardinal rules as they're often referred to, and they're not an Origin-specific thing, although the rules that we determined are specific to our own operations. They speak to approximately 35% of the reported unsafe acts, hazards, or incidents in our business. So let's explore what the rules actually are. The 11 rules are set out on the slide. They're widely used within the industries in which we work and range from simple instructions such as always wear a seatbelt when moving vehicles, when in a moving vehicle or operating plant. And the other one, which I think you'll notice is highlighted in red because they're the negative instructions, never position yourself under a suspended load. The 11 rules were determined by senior HSE representatives across all of our business, and these were landed to be the 11 highest risk consequence tasks, most representative of all our aggregated operations. There are many other high-risk activities that are undertaken across the organisation and many other HSE processes and rules that need to be followed. The life-saving rules don't make the others less important. These rules are now mandatory for all employees, contractors and visitors. The smallest deviation from these rules could result in tragic consequences, and it is for this reason that there is zero tolerance for breaking these rules. The life-saving rules were launched during Safety Week in October 2012. And I'd like to now show you some of the footage from that launch. The launch was based around a Life Is campaign and focused on why it is important at a personal level to have these rules in place. So activities included toolbox talks, both nationally and internationally, where all employees were invited to share their Life Is story, and competitions were held for the best participation. So you can see that employees were invited to share what returning home safely every night meant to them. Detailed line management briefings were held across the organisation. We held approximately 350 briefing sessions covering both employees and contractors. And we approached our major contracting companies who have also taken on board these life-saving rules. Implementation was completed at the end of March 2013, and there will be ongoing activity to ensure that the life-saving rules remain top of mind and that safety conversations continue across the group. So how do we link these two very, very different examples together? Irrespective of the size and industry of the company in which you work, the approach to governance remains the same. A risk awareness from the top and a culture which supports open and honest conversation, clear allocation of responsibility, and a framework which provides consistency and allows for the unique aspects of a risk profile to be understood and therefore managed. So where to from here? Well, there is one certainty. The landscape will continue to change, and the nature of risks under management will also change depending on the time and industry. Our challenge as risk managers is to remain consistently and sufficiently agile to respond to the challenges presented and to be consistent and confident in our own methodology to drive a culture of risk awareness so that we can future-proof our businesses. Thank you very much.